The biggest events sometimes turn on the smallest hinges. The biggest events sometimes turn on the smallest hinges. Kaiser Wilhelm II was the king of Prussia and the last German emperor. He ruled from June 1888 to November 1918. His aggressive policies, many historians say, were at least partly to blame for World War I. Well, back when he had been on the throne for a year, there was a special event taking place in Berlin. It was the Buffalo Bills Wild West show, which was touring through Europe. At one point in the show, as was the custom, Annie Oakley would do all sorts of tricks with her Colt 45. So at one point in the show, she would ask for a volunteer to hold a cigar in their mouth, and she would pace off her steps and shoot off the ashes of the cigar. This was a joke line, and people didn't volunteer for that. People would laugh, and then her helpless husband would always come up and hold the cigar. Well, one time after making the humorous announcement, Kaiser Wilhelm II walked into the arena and volunteered. He was a big fan of Annie's, and he wanted to show everyone how brave of a king he was. German policemen tried to stop him, but he waved them off. He wanted to hold the cigar. Well, at this point, Annie Oakley felt she couldn't back out of this and lose face, so she paced off her usual distance and prepared to shoot. One historian put it this way: sweating profusely under her buckskin and regretting she had consumed more than her usual amount of whiskey the night before, Annie raised her Colt, took aim, and blew away the ashes from Wilhelm's cigar. The historian goes on to say how the world might have been different if she had missed the cigar and creased his head instead. Would World War I been avoided if she'd been a worse shot on that day, just a little more whiskey, perhaps? Well, years later, after the World War I had begun, Annie wrote to Wilhelm asking if she could take a second shot. The biggest events sometimes turn on the smallest hinges. Kevin DeYoung gives a positive case in point by mentioning the time in the 1930s when an Englishman walking late at night in New York City was hit by a cab driver. That man was Winston Churchill. What if Churchill had died that day instead of just sustaining injuries? How might World War II have been different? The biggest events sometimes turn on the smallest hinges. A different shot here, a few more inches there. Well, that introduces us to our passage this morning in the book of Exodus, right? So I just threw that in. We're in Exodus now. We did finish Revelation. Exodus chapter 1. Turn there in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 1. We're beginning a new sermon series this morning entitled Through It All. Through it all. And if you're wondering how long we will be in the book of Exodus, well, remember, it took the Israelites 40 years. And you thought Revelation was a long time. Relax, it's only going to be for the summer months. The sermon series really is a character study on Moses. Why this study? What does the life of Moses have to do with you and me here in 2019? Well, what is super relatable about Moses' life is how he often found himself at the crossroads of choosing to go forward or turn back from following God. I mean, isn't that what life kind of boils down to? Through life's ups and downs, mistakes and regrets and troubles staring us in the face and people perhaps starting to get to us, will we choose to go forward or turn back from following the Lord? I mean, through it all, will you follow God? Now, I've chosen this study because in this room are people of various stages and seasons of life. There really isn't a one-size-fits-all model for Christian living as we navigate through all these seasons. But what we discover, at least hopefully we discover, is that through it all, God is working out his plans. Through it all is a God who shapes and affects every felt need we can imagine. My hope is that in our time together, looking at Moses' life, it will lift our view of God that can transcend all situations. Now, when I mention Moses, what comes to your mind? Well, you might say the burning bush. That was pretty cool. Or your minds immediately think of the parting of the Red Sea or the words to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And for some of you, when I mention Moses, you think of Charlton Heston. The Ten Commandments, yeah. And for many, the film production of Ten Commandments was then replaced with the animated film, The Prince of Egypt. And Moses went from strong, handsome, and confident to quick-witted and fun-loving. Either way, he was portrayed as a hero, and so be it. But hopefully, as we are drawn to the real-life character of Moses and can relate to the one who lived in our kind of world, we will be drawn to the one behind it all. We will see God's shaping of a man through all seasons of his life to accomplish his purposes. This morning, our takeaway is this. Give it to you up front. This is our takeaway. In a season where it seems we have been forgotten, we find that the presence of God was there all the time. In a season where it seems we've been forgotten, we find the presence of God was there all the time. That's what comes out in what we're going to look at this morning. Now, what might change if our lives, if we really believe this? I mean, what sin might we walk away from? What confidence might we gain? All right, look with me at Exodus chapter 1. Principle number one, blessings can come in bitter circumstances. Blessings can come in bitter circumstances. Now, we cannot detach a person from the times in which he lived. If we're going to understand the man Moses, we must know a little about his world as he entered it. For this baby about to be born would change history like a small hinge. What kind of world would Moses be born into? All right, look with me at Exodus chapter 1. Remember, you need to follow along because you know every once in a while I throw things in there that aren't here just to make sure you're awake. I don't have intention of doing that this morning, but you just never know. Chapter 1, verse 1. Exodus 1, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, the descendants of Jacob, numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now, Exodus 1 is the obvious beginning of the book, but it really is a continuation. Most translations have chosen not to capture it, but the first word in verse 1 is the word "and." And. I remember as a kid in school, I got marked down for beginning a sentence with "and." God began a whole book with the word "and." As a matter of fact, the book of Leviticus, next book, and then the book of Numbers, the book after that, they also begin with the word "and." The point is, we have one long continuing story. So we can't detach this story in Exodus chapter 1 to what was written in Genesis. Words here in chapter 1 take us back to the time of Moses. Why are the people, the time of Joseph, why are the people of God in Egypt? Short answer, Joseph. The longer answer is, Joseph's family came into Egypt because there was a famine in the land, and God providentially moved Joseph into Egypt in anticipation of this great famine. And so when the book of Exodus begins with the words, "and these are the names," it helps to connect it with the names that had come before in Genesis and that were continuing the story of these people who left their homeland and came into Egypt. And that's why it tells us in verse 6, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so the land was filled with them." Now there's a jam-packed verse there, because in verse 7, it uses seven words to describe the population explosion among the Israelites. God made them fruitful because God wanted to make his name great. Now, this is where there's a twist in the story right here. God making his name great through growing this nation was at direct odds with someone else who wants his name to be great. Verse 8. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. And like most dictators, the new pharaoh, this new king, was insecure and paranoid. So he tweets out to all his followers, verse 9, "Look, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." Now, the arrangement that was that Joseph, who saved Egypt by storing away food for the famine years, could take the best land and settle there, and he could bring his entire family. That was the arrangement. But in a world of politics, as we know, often it's all about who you know. And when Joseph's name came up, the new king would say, "Joseph who?" He never connected all these people to a man named Joseph. The new pharaoh did not know Joseph, or chose not to, and he felt no sense of obligation then to his descendants. And his reaction, have you noticed here, to the number of Israelites in his land? It is fear-based. Consider a recent decision you made based on fear. How did it turn out for you? See, a lot of what we do in our day-to-day stuff is driven by fear of some kind. You can always probably track it to that. Fear of what others might think, or fear of rejection, or fear of what your parents are going to do when they find out, or fear of a bad grade, or fear of an injury, or fear of failure, or fear of exposure. What are you afraid of in this season of your life? Fear of letting go? Fear of the unknown, and your mind's just constantly filled with the what-ifs? It just won't shut off? Are you afraid of being marginalized or unpopular or unliked? Or as the case with this new king, your fear is of losing control? Are you faced with a choice right now? How might fear drive your decision? Well, this new pharaoh and his insecurity and was threatened by these foreigners, so he got everyone else all worked up over these non-Egyptians in their midst. These people with funny-sounding accents and different skin color needed to be removed, or else they will take over. What is his plan? His plan to start having help so they won't continue to grow and have kids. His plan is give them the hardest work possible, and they'll stop having kids. I'm not sure what the correlation is, but you can let your minds wander there a bit if you want. I mean, was it they're just going to be so exhausted? Or conclude they don't want to bring kids into this kind of a society? Or they're going to be so overworked they just would die off? I mean, I'm not sure what the king was thinking here, but it didn't work. It was a poorly conceived plan, pun intended, by a very desperate man. Verse 12. But the more they were pressed, what happened? The more they multiplied and spread, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. Greater oppression, greater the growth. They were having more babies. God continued to bless them with kids. The king had forgotten Joseph, but did God forget his people? Israel was living under the blessing of God. But notice it was in the worst of times. Verses 13 and 14, it uses seven words here to describe Israel's bitter circumstances. It sounds a lot like verse 7, where seven words were used to describe their growth. Verse 13, and worked them ruthlessly. It's one word after another piled up here. They made their lives bitter with hard labor, in brick and mortar, and with all kinds of work in the fields, and all their hard labor. The Egyptians used them ruthlessly. Their situation was intolerable. Their bitter circumstances were very severe. But listen, blessings can come in bitter circumstances. We often can't see how they coexist. How can bitter circumstances and blessings be in the same sentence? Do you know bitter circumstances right now? Are you feeling, yet you're going through something that's extremely painful? Perhaps you're in a season of great family turmoil, or maybe you're in a season of pain because of the choices your kids might be making, or you silently suffer this morning because you want children and you can't, or you want to be married and it hasn't worked out yet. And you come in here silently suffering over that. You're bitter for you. Perhaps you're in some job that's making your life miserable, or you wish you had a job. And that's your misery. It could be a number of things causing this season to feel bitter to you. But listen to these down-to-earth words by John Piper. In his book, A Sweet and Bitter Providence, John Piper says this: life is not a straight line leading from one blessing to the next and then finally to heaven. Life is a winding and troubled road, switchback after switchback. And the point of biblical stories is to help us feel in our bones, not just in our heads, that God is for us and all these strange turns. God is not just showing up after the trouble and cleaning it up. He's plotting the course and managing the troubles with far-reaching purposes for our good and for the glory of Jesus Christ. EBC, embrace those words. Grab it. Because if you're in a season right now where you may feel like God has forgotten you, hopefully someday you'll find that God's presence was there all the time. Because it is. He's never left us. Blessings can come in bitter circumstances. That's principle number one. I need to give you a second principle. Principle number two. The best choice is to value God's favor more than the favor of anyone else. The best choice, you might say always, is to value God's favor more than the favor of anyone else. Plan A didn't work. Plan B, we're going to go on to plan B, verse 15. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names are Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live. Now, it isn't likely that these two women are the only two midwives at that time. I mean, it just wouldn't make sense with all the babies being born. It's doubtful that two midwives could get that job done alone. So it's safe to assume that these two midwives are called in because they're in charge of all the other midwives. So I'm going to tell you two, you get it out, word out to all the other midwives. But the command is pretty black and white. He wanted all the boys killed so that the Israelites' army would be weakened. After all, he's still acting out of fear, and he doesn't want a war to break out with all these foreigners choosing the opposite side of the king. Now, as the king, he could have ordered his men to kill off all the Hebrew young men and all these baby boys. But in an attempt to kind of keep this under the radar, he approaches this sneakily and secretly. He tries to get the job done through these midwives and make these deaths look like stillborn death. As soon as they're born, you make sure you snuff life out of them. Does this not have a similar ring to it of the heinous practice today of partial birth abortions? Does it not? Now, I find it interesting that you have a king whose name is not mentioned. He's just kind of King What's-His-Name. And you have two midwives whose names are memorialized for all time. Why? Verse 17. I believe verse 17 is the key verse in this section. Five words that summed up their actions. But the midwives feared God. That's it. But the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Now, might they have rationalized this? We need to submit to the king. He's the one in authority. We're just doing what we're told here. It's not really as if we're murdering these babies. I mean, and he's probably going to kill them anyway. And maybe we can just kill off a few of them and then let the rest live, and that will satisfy him. And really, what kind of life are these babies, these kids going to have in this hostile environment? We're doing them a favor. But the midwives feared God and did not do. Think of the predicament they're in. These women had a lot to lose: their jobs, their livelihood, their safety, their heads. What tipped the scales? But the midwives feared God and did not do. What do you fear? What do I fear? Do we value God's favor more than the favor of anyone else? They feared God and did not do. Think of a present situation you're in right now that causes you to fear God over fearing anything else, over fearing other people. What is your fear God and did not do situation right now? How convinced are you that the best way to go through life is to fear God, to want His favor on your life? And so these two pro-life midwives said no to the most powerful man in the world at that time. The two midwives get called into the principal's office, verse 18. Now, I believe that between verse 16 and verse 18, that some time has elapsed. It's likely several years, because, when they finally would see that their plan wasn't working, that some people would come to the king and say, "You know, king, there are still a lot of boys running around among the Israelites. I thought we'd only be seeing anything but girls. Something's fishy." So the king calls in the two midwives into his office, and he asks them, "What has been going on?" And the midwives fear God and chose to obey God over the king and did not follow through on what the king commanded. Again, Pharaoh was the most powerful man in the world at that time. With a simple word, he could have had these women executed. But these two women, get this, these two women feared the giver of life more than they feared the one who could take their lives. Look at their answer, verse 19. I love their answer, verse 19. I'm sorry, I'm going to see some humor here. If you don't, that's your problem. I see it. Their answer, verse 19, they say, okay, what's going on here? Why is this happening? Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. In other words, they're giving birth on the elevator. They're giving the birth on the parking lot of the hospital. And the cab drive over, they're giving birth. We can't do anything about it. We can't get there on time. That's what they're saying. Now, I might be reading more into this, but it sounds to me that these midwives are also, they're mocking Pharaoh to suggest that the Hebrew women were tougher than the Egyptians was a bit of humor, a tongue-in-cheek statement. I mean, really, if this is true, why would these Hebrew women even need midwives? But what they said satisfied Pharaoh. He was satisfied with their answer. And as one writer put it, it seems that on this occasion, at least, Pharaoh was a few bricks shy of a pyramid. Now, we kind of go off the rails here and we start going, oh, wait a minute, they fibbed. Do the ends justify the means? Are they lying here? Now, even if it's partially true, it's still misleading. It's a classic question asked in your ethics class or philosophy 101. If the Nazis came to your door during World War II and asked, "Are you hiding Jews?" what's the right thing to do? I want us to process this a little bit, but you can think on this and do your own thinking on this and exploration of it. But are you obligated to tell them the truth? Are you obligated to tell people with evil intentions the whole truth and nothing but the truth? I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. It doesn't fit my purposes for today. There's no indication here that what they did was wrong. On the contrary, God is pleased by their actions. He blesses them. He blesses them. They feared the Lord and they did what was right. Here's my conclusion on it. We are not under any obligation to tell the truth to intruders, those intent on evil, and to those who would harm us or our family. That's my take. You can disagree. You can explore it. I want to get on the back on the main road here, okay? Here's the main point. I mean, after all, he is on the life of Moses, and I've hardly mentioned him this morning. Plan A didn't work. Plan B didn't work. Now on to plan C. Verse 22, Pharaoh the king gives an order to all the people, and the order is this: any baby boy that they see born should be thrown into the Nile River. And it's implied, and in some manuscripts, it states that it's a reference just to all the Hebrew boys. That would make the most sense. Not all the boys, just Hebrew boys. But do you see it? Pharaoh tried everything to stop the baby boom, but they kept growing because God's blessing was invincible. God's fingerprints are all over this. They might have felt forgotten, but God's presence was there all the time. Principle number three, we come right back to where we began. Big events sometimes turn on the smallest of hinges. Principle number three. Big events sometimes turn the smallest of hinges. God has a plan to rescue the nation of Israel, and it all hinges on a baby boy born to two unknown parents who aren't even named here. Chapter 2, verse 1. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, we all think we have that fine child, gorgeous, beautiful, right? Little more than just, oh, he's so beautiful, most beautiful baby ever. More than that, they're seeing something else about this child. Okay, it's really hard to translate fine there. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Now we're told in Hebrews chapter 11 that her name was Jochebed. And she and her husband are mentioned, by the way, in Hebrews chapter 11 for their faith. It says of them in Hebrews 11 that they did not fear the king's edict. So Moses' mom, Jochebed, hides the baby for 3 months. But after a while, that cute little cry of a newborn baby gets louder and louder and louder. Hard to hide, pretty difficult to hide the baby at that point. So mom, Moses' mom, takes a basket. Likely, it's more like a chest. Don't picture some flimsy-looking wicker basket that's wobbling all over the place. It's sturdy and it's solid. Interestingly, the word used here for basket is the word ark. It's only used here and in the case of the ark that Noah built. So she built an ark, not Noah's size ark. Didn't have time for that. Much smaller scale, but it served the same purpose. Keep the boy inside from drowning. The mom then takes some tar-like goop and waterproofs it. And she doesn't send them out into the current, but places the basket along the new bank, the riverbank, among the sturdy reeds. Okay, moms, can you imagine placing your child in this basket and sending your child along the banking of the river? I mean, I know there are days you feel like sending them out on the river, but that's not what I'm talking about. This would be gut-wrenching. The mother does all she can to do here that she can do, and then she trusts God with the rest. I'm told there's a famous sign during World War II. The British government made signs saying, keep calm and carry on. Keep calm and carry on. And I kind of go, who in the world can keep calm when you're being bombed and having air raids from above? Keep calm, carry on. And others have played off this sign. You can go on Google this, but some has had keep calm and carry on eating Oreos. Keep calm and eat chocolate. Or keep calm and just dance. Or keep calm and don't forget to be awesome. That was one I saw. And keep calm and blog on. Someone decided to flip this around and say, now panic and freak out. Moses' mother doesn't freak out. She stayed calm and carried on. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't cry out for deliverance. It doesn't mean you just sit around and do nothing. We can remain calm and knowing that God is still in charge, but carry on, persist. And so the baby, tells us in verse 5 and 6, is placed in some reeds. And when the princess, Pharaoh's daughter, goes to bathe, she sees the basket. She hears this crying inside the basket. She looks inside and seeing the baby, she is filled with compassion. And then unbeknownst to the princess, Moses' sister, likely it was Miriam, verse 7, she's standing nearby and suggests that a Hebrew woman nurse the baby. Now, I don't know about you, but this is where my mind starts asking a lot of questions. Did all this just happen this way and with Moses' sister, and she's thinking quickly on her feet and she makes this wonderful suggestion? Or is this all planned? I mean, did the family all huddle together and say, we're going to send Moses out in a basket? This is our best shot here. So Miriam, you go and you stand by the river. Pharaoh's daughter has this routine of going to the river and bathing at the certain time of day. And when she sees this cute little baby that she won't be able to resist, you come in and you say, hey, I have an idea. Maybe. Well, Miriam comes back home later that day and yells, Mom! Mom, it worked! Or if it wasn't all planned, that'd be quite a gift for Mom. You're going to get your baby back. You're going to get to nurture Moses. And you'll even get paid for it. There's so much irony in this true story. Moses' mom not only gets her baby boy back for a season to train the things of God, but she gets paid for it. And unless I miss my guess, that money's coming from Pharaoh's bank account. Now, Miriam doesn't get a lot of press, but she does a remarkable thing here that advances the story of Moses. It says that Moses' sister, like I said, probably Miriam, verse 4, it says, stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Now, we find that same figure of speech, that idiom in the book of Esther, when it says that Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Same figure of speech. Mordecai pacing back and forth, concerned about Esther. Where's Esther? What's going on? Well, this is what Moses' sister Miriam is doing. She's wondering, what's going to happen to my little brother? Is he going to be okay? But she wasn't about to send one of her siblings floating down the river by himself. Some of you just might like to send your sibling down the river. All he does is cry anyway. Send him off. Not Miriam. This is remarkable to me because this young girl and its guest, she's probably anywhere between 6 and 14 years old. She courageously stands against the majority, impressively articulates to the princess a satisfying option. Here's a kid who's playing a big part in God's plan bigger than she knew. She is a hero in this story. A big event turns on this small hinge. How about you? Young person, how about you? Listen, don't write yourself off in what you can do for God. You might be here and go, you know, someday I'll do something for God, but you know, right now, I'm just trying to stay alive in Minecraft. I'm trying to get all my weapons and equipment in Fortnite. That's all I'm trying to do. Listen, God is so much more for you than that. I'm not slamming that. Maybe I am, but I'm not saying you can't do that and serve God, because you can. But would you be able to speak up like this to an adult, the daughter of the king? Would you want to? Would you have said, yeah, I don't really know who he belongs to, but good luck to you with him. All he does is cry anyway. History turns on the smallest hinges of the actions of a few people. And did you notice? They were all women. Along with young Miriam, there are several other women stars in this story. The two midwives who feared God over fearing the king and what he could do to them. You have the mother of Moses who did not fear the king's edict and in faith hid the boy. Here's more irony for you. Pharaoh was so concerned about little boys growing up to become men who would fight against him when all the while he's being outmatched by one woman after another. Perhaps he should have been more concerned about the female population. women, many of you are in a very busy season of your life. And if you have children right now, your goal just might be to survive. There are more of them than there are of me. I just want 4 hours of sleep. I get that. But God's plan of redemption, God's plan of redemption hinged on a few women loving the kids God placed in their lives. Pretty simple. It might have seemed insignificant at the time, but God was up to something massive that would become known to all. And so regardless of where you are, man, woman, young, old, wherever you find yourself this morning, whether it's a time of prosperity or in a time of just everything's going bad for you, maybe it's a mix of bitter and sweet. God not only knows where you are, but he wants to use your circumstances to move his plan forward. And so whether you're in a season of pleasure or in a season of pain, you can become useful in God's hands for God's sovereign purposes. Because in a season where it may seem like you have been forgotten, you hopefully will find the presence of God was there all the time. There are divine fingerprints all over this true story. You never know how your faithful actions will be what God uses to accomplish his purposes. We never know what God is up to. Consider what God might be doing right now through you for the growth of this church or the good of his people or the fulfillment of his plans for his glory. Because his plan may turn on the hinge of your routine faithfulness. May. Charles Plum, a U.S. Navy, Naval Academy graduate, was a jet fighter pilot in Vietnam. And after 75 combat missions, his plane was destroyed by a surface-to-air missile. Plum ejected and parachuted into enemy hands, and he was captured and spent 6 years in a communist prison. He survived that ordeal, and now, after that time, he would go around and lecture about lessons from that experience. One day, when Plum and his wife were sitting in a restaurant, there was a man at another table, and he came up to him. He says, "You're Plum. You flew jet fighters in Vietnam from the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk, and you were shot down." "Well, how in the world did you know that?" asked Plum. "I packed your parachute," the man replied. Plum gasped in surprise and gratitude. The man pumped his hand and said, "I guess it worked." Plum assured him, "Yeah, it sure did. If your chute hadn't worked, I wouldn't be here today." Plum couldn't sleep that night thinking about that man. And Plum says, "I kept wondering what he might have looked like in Navy uniform, a Dixie cup hat, a bib in the back, and bell-bottom trousers. I wondered how many times I might have passed him on the Kitty Hawk. I wondered how many times I might have seen him and not even said, 'Good morning, how are you,' or anything, because you see, I was a fighter pilot and he was just a sailor." Plum thought of the many hours the sailor had spent on a long wooden table in the bowels of the ship, carefully weaving the shrouds and folding the silks of each shoot, holding in his hands each time the fate of someone he didn't even know. Now, whenever Plum lectures, he asks his audience, "Who's packing your parachute? Who's packing your parachute?" See, church, every community needs every person playing their part if it is to function successfully. Some of those parts will be the glamorous roles, like the fighter pilot, while others are behind the scenes, out of the way, and apparently unimportant jobs like parachute packing. But they're all vital. God wants to use you to accomplish his purposes. It might be fighting on the front lines. It might be packing parachutes. But whatever it is, whatever it is, be faithful to do what it is that's in your control and trust God with the rest. That's what we see. Let's pray.